We are back. Alan Guth is helping us understand the universe at its largest and its smallest. Some of what you say is intuitively obvious, she says. Some of it I can follow your logic if I hold on really tight. But when you tell me that all of it comes to zero, it gives me pause. It's also incredibly exciting that at this point you're telling me that logic and intuition are the same. It all comes to zero, which is not nothing. Is that right?
It's a lot like accounting.
Well, that's right, actually. One of the fascinating things is that if all this is correct, it really does make a big change on the way physicists used to think about things. We used to think that the number of possible states a system could have always went up with energy. And that to have a lot of different possibilities, you needed a lot of energy. If this is right, we're saying that at zero energy, there's essentially an infinite number of possible states. And that really does confuse physicists quite a bit. And there are a lot of features of that that we're still trying to explore and wrestle with.
Since I am not in any way confused by the realities of physics, doesn't that also liberate you to think about things quite differently and in quite new ways? Doesn't that open doors that had been closed?
Oh, yeah, it certainly does. And lots of different avenues are being explored.
Is this part of what you said, things are happening and fermenting in the cosmology business at the moment?
Yeah, very much. Both on the theoretical and observational side. The theoretical side is most closely related to what we're saying now, but the observational side is also moving along with an incredible pace, and it's equally and spectacularly exciting. On the theoretical side, the idea that you could build a universe with zero energy, first of all, means that you could just as equally well build an infinite number of universes as one universe.
You say that so lightly.
And it's all infinite... free. I mean, you don't have to put anything in.
That's right. That's right.
But that's so far beyond the ability to imagine. I can't imagine
right.
The universe, and here you want me imagining an infinite number of universes. Come on.
That's right. That's right. Well, it is mind-boggling. It is mind-boggling. In fact, most versions of inflation really predict that there should be an infinite number of universes produced and not just one. The reason, basically, is that when this peculiar anti-gravity material is undergoing this rapid expansion, it eventually ends because the material is unstable. So eventually it becomes normal, and then you just have expanding ordinary matter, which is the Big Bang. But the catch is that it doesn't all go normal at once. The process of going normal is really like a decay process, the way radioactive substances decay. So it has a half-life. So if you wait a certain length of time called the half-life, half of it will have gone normal. But the peculiar thing is that it's expanding faster than it's decaying. So although half of it will have gone normal after one half-life, the half that remains in this repulsive gravity state is in fact much larger than what you started with. And you wait another half-life, it gets larger still, and it goes on forever. So in almost all forms of inflation that we know of, the end result is not merely the creation of one universe, but an endless creation of universes.
You stopped me cold there.
that does raise, you had a challenge early on in this, trying to figure out how inflation ended. And what I just heard you say is it didn't really end.
It did not end everywhere. It
ended locally.
It certainly did end in the region of space that we're now living in.
But there's no reason. In fact, there are powerful theoretical mathematical reasons that to assume and even assert that it has continued. It's just our local variant of it stopped, and we inhabit the world that we inhabit now once it stopped.
That is right.
Isn't this a very humbling business in which you are?
Well, yes. On the other hand, it's also in some ways invigorating. As soon as you start to think about cosmology, you find yourself in a humble position to start with, because the universe is just plain big.
There's no way to express, and there's so many of them.
Even if there was just one of them, and even if there was only the part
and you're only talking about the observable
that's
universe.
That's right, and I'm only talking about the observable universe. If inflation is right, it's probably a lot bigger than that. But just the observable universe contains about something on the order of 100 billion galaxies. And each of those galaxies contains about 100 billion stars. It really is just fantastic how large the universe is and how small we are in comparison. So once you get over that, then the part that makes you feel good is the fascination that we can perhaps understand this gigantic universe that we live in.
You talk about the economy of nature. You talk about the simple, elegant answers being the best answers. Isn't that some of what you're moving toward as you say this to me? That the joy is to find the simplicity of the enormity? I just made that up. But isn't there something in that?
Well, I think so. And I think that is what fascinates most physicists. The more we learn about nature, in many ways, the simpler nature appears. The whole advent of grand unified theories, for example, is really a simplification of the previous version where there were three different kinds of interactions, which now all get put together in grand unified theories into one kind of interaction. And now there's a very strong movement going on in physics, which I've had nothing to do with myself, but I'm following it from a distance and might jump into it. It's very exciting to try to really describe all four forces in terms of one single theory, what's called string theory or superstring theory.
What's the point of that? Why do we care so much?
Well, I think the reason why I care and most of my immediate colleagues care is just the fascination of understanding it all. And the utter amazement at finding out that it may be possible to explain the tremendous complexity that we see in the universe in terms of underlying very simple principles.
You talk about, in that context, the absolute joy 10 years later, having developed the theory, when the data finally came back from the cosmic background radiation experiments, and the data precisely fit well within the experimental error, the theory. And there's something about the ability to somehow or other grasp something that is seemingly ungraspable, and to be able to predict and understand, and in some sense understand.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's fascinating, and certainly when the data came back from the Cosmic Background Explorer of the first measurements of the non-uniformities of the cosmic background radiation, it was just amazing. When I and other people were working on calculating the predictions for that from inflationary models, it was about 10 years prior to the measurements. When we were doing the calculations, I really don't think any of us had the faintest idea that this would ever be measurable. I think we all were under the belief that these fluctuations, these non-uniformities, were just too small to ever be measured in our lifetime.
Then
10 years later, when that was just measured and they had these wonderful curves.
Some of the excitement of the story that you tell is this leap in time that somebody thinks it up, and then sometime later somebody figures out how to measure it. And the Siamese twin nature of the theory and the observation was very striking to me. You guys can't do without each other, can you?
No, oh, that's right. That's right. Cosmology certainly is, in the end, has to be an observational science if it's to be a science. And it is. And by the way, let me just stick in a plug for new observations. The cosmic background radiation business was revolutionized by the COBE satellite, which was launched in 1990. In the year 2000, NASA is scheduled to launch a follow-up satellite to COBE called MAP, the Microwave Anisotropy Probe, and it will revolutionize the whole business again. It is so much more precise.
So you're not done?
What?
You're not done?
That's what we're not done, no. So far, the data agrees beautifully with the predictions of inflation, but so far the error bars are still very large. The MAP satellite is going to be so much more precise. The angular resolution, for example, the ability to distinguish short wavelength differences from one direction to another, is about 60 or so times better for the MAP satellite as it was with COBE. It's just unbelievable the improvements that have been made and the wealth of data that these new observations are going to bring back.
You said early on that the next 4 or 5 years are going to bring all sorts of miraculous. What do you think we will know in that 4 or 5 year period? What will we understand that we don't understand or not have not demonstrated yet?
Well, it's a little hard to make firm predictions about understanding because we don't know what the answers are or what exactly there will be to be understood. But in terms of just plain sheer measurement of properties of the universe, right now, for example, we really don't know whether the mass density of the universe is 0.1 of the critical density or perhaps equal to the critical density. I think in 5 years we will know to within 10%, 5% what the mass density of the universe is. Right now we only know the expansion rate of the universe to an accuracy of, depends who you ask, maybe 20 or 30%. And it makes a big difference for comparing theories. In 5 years, I think we probably will know it to an accuracy of on the order of 5%. We also don't now know something which is quite important. There have been recent observations that the universe may actually be accelerating today rather than slowing down, which would, the simplest explanation for that would be the appearance of what Einstein called the cosmological constant, which Einstein introduced back in 1917 for all the wrong reasons. He was at that time under the belief that the universe was static. He had discovered that his theory of general relativity predicted that gravity would just crush a static universe. It wouldn't stay static. It would collapse. So he wanted to invent a repulsive force that could suspend the universe against collapse. So he introduced this extra term to his gravitational equations, which he called the cosmological term.
It's sort of a plug factor to get where you want to be.
That's right. No, it was definitely introduced as a fudge factor for fudging to, you know, produce a wrong theory in this case. Today we interpret it a little bit differently from the way Einstein did. From a modern point of view, a cosmological constant would really correspond to attributing an energy density to empty space. But it would, as Einstein had described, it would describe a repulsive force. And there are observations that indicate the universe may actually be doing that. And that will get cleared up, hopefully.
Cleared up, indeed. Well, you'll have to help me clear that up when we come back. This is Alan Guth. We're at MIT, and we're going to be back in just a moment.